a place where the critically ill patient might not just be studied, but treated. That was the place the Wolverines needed to be. A place where you could say to yourself that you were more or less right, even if you were a little bit wrong, but a place that you had gotten to fast so that you might act. The next day, the first American tested positive for the new virus. He was a man in his 30s who had traveled a week before from Wuhan to Seattle. Still, the United States government was showing no sign of alarm. The only action the CDC had taken was to issue a travel alert and to screen travelers entering the United States from China for fever. "It's one person coming in from China, and we have it under control," said President Trump. "It's going to be just fine." When he uttered those words, he was at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. So too, as it happened, were Rajiv Venkaya and Richard Hatchett. "Rajiv and I had breakfast this morning," Richard wrote to the others, "and were imagining someone going to get caught in a forest or a cave or on a remote windswept plain, kind of like Ray going to find Luke." Another movie reference, Star Wars, Episode 8, The Last Jedi. That's when Carter finally materialized. "You and Rajiv must have ESP about me being in a remote place," he wrote to Richard. "Caught up on the ride home. Agree with your rough estimate. About 1% of Americans travel outside the U.S. each month for comparison. Maybe disease outbreaks need a warning like the one on your car mirror. Things are much larger than they appear." Back at his desk, Carter collected the official statistics from China. Cases, hospitalizations, deaths. He compared them to whatever he could find in Chinese blogs and newspapers. It was slow going, as much of the information he found was in Chinese. "I had no idea what the stuff was," he said. "It was all gobbledygook to me. My computer kept lighting up. This site is unsafe." He'd cut and paste what he found into Google Translate just to see what it was. Some were death notices. He saw that the dates on deaths reported by the authorities every day at midnight were later than the dates in the local reports. That is, the 37 people in Wuhan who had reportedly died by January 23rd had died earlier than the official stats suggested. The timing was important. "I was trying to get a sense of how old the starlight was," said Carter. "The average time from infection to death was maybe 2 weeks. And so the deaths gave you a sense of how widespread the disease had been maybe 2 weeks earlier. If on top of that, the Chinese were slow to report the deaths, the lag in the multiple was even greater." He noticed that while the Chinese government had been reporting only a handful of cases 2 weeks earlier, they were now behaving as if there had been many more. Reading tea leaves, he wrote to his fellow Wolverines, "I see that China is building a 1,000-bed quarantine hospital in Wuhan in 5 days. They also called in the military to assist. Reminds me of the military called in to Chernobyl." He wasn't working alone, at least as he saw it. All the Wolverines chipped in. Richard Hatchett was in constant touch with his friend, Neil Ferguson, a leading modeler at Imperial College in London. Ferguson had guessed the R-naught at 3, which is to say that, at the start of the outbreak, each infected person was infecting 3 others. That was shocking, and the fastest-moving flu on record, the flu that created the 1918 pandemic, the initial reproductive rate had been 1.8. The reproductive cycle was roughly a week. If you had 300 cases a week ago, you would have 900 cases today. If those 300 cases had actually been identified a month ago, you would have 24,300 today. At some point, it became math, but to do the math, you needed to make some guesses about exactly how fast the virus was moving. Carter accepted that no one would have a full, clear picture of the speed of the virus until it was too late, and he set out to generate as many partial fuzzy ones as he could. His approach was a peculiar combination of analysis and analogies. "You rely on patterns," he said. "That is exactly what analogies provide. But you need to temper that, because you can see patterns that aren't really there. The analogies are shortcuts, really the equivalent of deductive wormholes that take me very quickly from A to B." In effect, he was asking, what other virus does this virus most closely resemble? The obvious first answer was the new virus's closely known genetic relative, the original SARS of 2003. Carter stayed up all that first night creating a spreadsheet that listed, side by side, the reported cases and the deaths in the first 44 days of both SARS outbreaks. They were so similar. The same number of identified cases and deaths on the same days, that at first it was impossible to tell them apart. The original SARS had infected only 8,000 people, killing 800 before it was contained. This new SARS had similar official stats, but he saw signs that the stats were misleading. The new SARS was spreading much more quickly from country to country than the original, for example. It was also eliciting very different behavior from the Chinese government. On January 23rd, the authorities closed Wuhan and forbade anyone from entering or leaving the city. It underscores the point that Richard has made many times about how hard it is to get a feel for how bad or mild an outbreak is while it is happening around you, Carter wrote. "I could be wrong, but this just doesn't feel mild." Then he nodded in the direction of the 1918 pandemic. Wuhan equals Philadelphia. "Hopefully we are watching and learning like St. Louis. We are soon going to be running uphill from a brush fire." On January 24th, the CDC announced the second case in the United States. The woman had traveled from Wuhan. The next day, January 25th, the Chinese reported 2,298 cases, up from 446, 4 days earlier. "Epidemics don't behave like this," Carter wrote. The newly infected did not quintuple in 5 days. He suspected that the Chinese were catching up on their reporting. Still, the sudden leap in case numbers was shocking. He noted that the Chinese government started building yet another giant hospital in Wuhan, this one with 1,300 beds. Back in 1918, government officials had thrown up new hospitals in Philadelphia, too. He also read the news that a prominent ear, nose, and throat doctor in Wuhan had died of the new virus. That put paid to the idea, still at large, that all the infections were being caused by humans coming into contact with animals. It also suggested the virus's stealth. Even people who knew enough to wear protective gear could be infected. "It just flashes warning lights," said Carter. "It could have been sloppy infection control, or it could mean something more concerning." He found yet another article about a Chinese man identified as the source of the infection in several others, who had himself experienced no symptoms. If true, cases were going not just unreported, but entirely undetected. Taken together, the stories he dug out of public sources helped to explain why the Chinese government was behaving as if the virus was spreading much faster than the reported numbers, and also faster than the original SARS. What Carter couldn't understand was why the United States government lacked the same urgency. "I suspect that a significant number of infected individuals made it past the CDC entry screen and have likely already infected others," he wrote in an email to the Wolverines. "We are already far behind the curve, and fire is racing up the hill, but we haven't gone far enough down the valley to see it." He had fire on the brain. Fire was his favorite metaphor to convey how hard it was for people to wake up to a threat that grew exponentially. One fire in particular had captivated his and Richard's imagination when they'd read of it years earlier. It was known as the Man Gulch Fire, after the area in Montana that had burned back in 1949. A decade earlier, the U.S. Forest Service had created an elite team of smoke jumpers who parachuted into fires. One August afternoon, 15 young men, most between the ages of 17 and 23, parachuted into what they thought was a small and simple fire. They landed by 4:10 p.m. and began to hike down into Man Gulch, with their heavy packs and Pulaski axes on their backs. They didn't know each other, and, as they hiked, split into smaller groups. To their right was a steep ridge, to their left, a creek. The fire they'd been sent to fight burned safely on the other side of that creek, or so they imagined. There weren't many trees, just tall grass, but they were unable to see much ahead of them. A mile or so down the gulch, the creek drained into the Missouri River. Their plan was to walk to the river, cross over the creek, and fight the fire with the river at their backs. The river at their backs was their escape route. But as they neared the river, there came a shocking sight. Fire. It had jumped across the creek and now blocked them from the river. Worse, it was moving across the grass toward them. One moment the fire had been invisible, the next a terrifying wall of flames 30 feet high. It was now 5:45. They turned to flee, but the only escape route was up and over the steep ridge. Investigators later measured the ridge's 76% slope. The fire had a tailwind of 30 or maybe even 40 miles an hour and was growing exponentially. Grass fires moved faster than forest fires. The investigators later estimated that the grass fire had been moving at 1.2 miles per hour when the young men first spotted it. 10 minutes later, at 5:55, the fire was traveling at 7 miles per hour. 1 minute later, at 5:56, the hands on the wristwatch of one of the young men melted in place. That's how the investigators determined exactly when 10 of the 15 had burned to death, some still carrying their heavy packs and Pulaski axes. The other 5 had escaped. 3 had dropped their Pulaskis and made it over the top of the ridge, though 1 died the next day of his burns. The 4th was also dead within a day. The 5th, their 33-year-old leader, the beautifully named Wag Dodge, survived. His was the most interesting story, at least to Carter. At 5:55 p.m., with the fire just a minute away and rushing toward him at ever greater speed, he'd lit up a second fire up the hill he needed to climb. As his fire burned the grass in front of him, he walked into it and threw himself onto the hot ashes. He'd called for his men first to abandon their packs and Pulaskis, and then to follow him into the fire he'd set. Either they didn't hear him or thought he'd lost his mind. At any rate, they didn't really know Wag Dodge or have any reason to trust him. Dodge alone heard and felt the main fire passing by on either side of him, leaving him unscathed. Until that moment, there was no history of a firefighter having done such a thing, but it became an accepted strategy in the fighting of grass fires. Escape fire was what they'd call it. The event so captivated the writer, Norman MacLean, best known for his only other book, A River Runs Through It, that he wrote a book about it called Young Men and Fire. It so interested a doctor named Don Berwick, maybe best known for running Medicaid and Medicare during part of the Obama administration, that he'd given a talk about it. Carter had heard the talk and thought, the Man Gulch fire isn't about fire, or at least not only about fire. It's also about pandemics. In fire, you could see lessons for fighting a raging disease. He jotted them down. You cannot wait for the smoke to clear. Once you can see things clearly, it is already too late. You can't outrun an epidemic. By the time you start to run, it is already upon you. Identify what is important and drop everything that is not. Figure out the equivalent of an escape fire. The Mann Gulch fire captured the difficulty people had imagining exponential growth, even when their lives depended on it. We are reactive and tend to only intervene when things are getting bad, wrote Carter. And what we underestimate is the speed that what's bad moves. At midnight on January 26, the Chinese authorities announced 2,700 new cases and 80 new deaths. I thought back to 2009, H1N1, wrote Carter at 6 the next morning, and remembered how we used the 1918 pandemic as the model in our heads, the movie. And a lesson I learned would be to be careful the next time to not cling to a single model, movie in my head, but use a range. I almost fell into the same trap this time by focusing on SARS. I did pull the 2009 H1N1 data, but didn't look at the data as closely as I should have. I finally did last night. What he saw in that data was that, while the number of deaths looked a lot like the number in the early stage of the SARS outbreak, the speed at which the disease moved did not. It was moving much, much faster, and very like the swine flu had moved. The movie isn't SARS, and the case ascertainment isn't SARS. It is more like H1N1. It was as if he'd taken the virus to a clothing store and tried trousers on it until he found the best fit. H1N1 fit this new virus and the speed at which it was traveling. There was good news and bad news here. The good news was that it meant that a lot more people were surviving the virus than anyone knew. The bad news was that the virus would infect and kill vastly more people than the original SARS. Carter found a study that the CDC had made, after the fact, of the cases of swine flu that had gone undetected, or at least unrecorded, back in 2009. The numbers were incredible. For every case that had been recorded, somewhere between 18 and 40 cases had been missed. He then asked, what if right now, health authorities around the world were detecting only between 1 in 18 and 1 in 40 cases? Yesterday, we had 2,700 cases and 80 deaths, wrote Carter. Let's assume the real number of cases is 18 to 40 times greater, or 48,600 to 108,000. The 80 deaths were the result of some lower number of infections that had occurred roughly 2 weeks earlier. To figure out the fatality rate of the virus, you needed to know how many cases there had been. Carter did some rough math, using a reproductive rate of 2 on the low side and 3 on the high side. That is, each week, the number of cases was either doubling or tripling. The case count 2 weeks ago would be 1/4 or 1/9 of 48,600 to 108,000, or 5,400 to 27,000, he wrote, and was likely doing the math in his head as he did. So 80 deaths with a denominator of 5,400 to 27,000 projected cases 2 weeks ago gives us a case fatality rate of 0.3% to 1.5%. But these are very crude estimates. He was under no illusion that he was engaged in anything resembling scholarship. He was simply trying to learn enough about the virus to make decisions about it. For instance, he might help the leader of the Veterans Health Administration prepare the nation's largest hospital system for the onslaught. The other Wolverines all had decisions to make too, and the faster they made them, the more lives would be saved. Matt Hepburn, for instance, had spent much of the previous decade inside DARPA, the Department of Defense's elite research unit, working on rapid vaccine development. Hepburn would eventually be in charge of vaccine development for Operation Warp Speed. He needed to know whether to throw the weight of that massive agency behind the chase for a coronavirus vaccine. In making that judgment, he, like the other Wolverines, was now more or less entirely dependent on the group's collective wisdom and the curious talents of Carter Mesher. "We knew none of this stuff could ever be published anywhere," said Carter. "What we were trying to do was a quick reckoning of what the hell was going on, so we could take action. We weren't doing this for the federal government. We were doing it for each other." Still, they could hardly ignore the federal government. They watched the U.S. government repatriate Americans from Wuhan on January 29th. The first group went to March Air Reserve Base in Riverside County, California. The second, in early February, to four different places, one of them a National Guard base just outside Omaha, where they remained quarantined for 14 days. The Omaha National Guard base was a short drive from the Global Center for Health Security, the place charged with treating Americans infected with mysterious new pathogens, and run by James Lawler. Lawler discovered, and could not quite believe, that the CDC didn't plan to test any of the new arrivals unless they had a fever. All of the foreigners being shipped home from Wuhan were being tested before they got on the plane, and the CDC felt that was adequate. The Germans and the Australians and the Japanese had tested all of their citizens after they'd flown home from Wuhan and discovered that 1 to 2% of them were infected, and that many of those had no symptoms. The tests in Wuhan hadn't identified any of them. Lawler called the CDC to ask if he might test the Americans now quarantined down the road from his hospital, if for no reason other than to make sure they didn't let them loose while they were still shedding the virus. "There was very little data to support the 14-day quarantine," he said. "There are clearly people who have incubation periods of 21 days. I thought we needed to know if they were infected when they got here or shedding when they leave." He and his staff had already created their own test, based on the test created by the World Health Organization, and so they didn't require the CDC's help, merely its approval. The CDC sent one of its epidemiologists to visit James Lawler. At the end of the meeting, the guy said he needed to check with Atlanta. "The next day I got this panicked call from him," said Lawler. "It's gone all the way up to CDC Director Robert Redfield. He said, 'You can't do it.' I said, 'Why?' He said I would be doing research on imprisoned persons. Never mind that every single one of the 57 Americans in quarantine wanted to be tested. The CDC forbade it. And Lawler never understood the real reason for the CDC's objections. Did they want to avoid finding cases to avoid displeasing Donald Trump? Were they concerned that if they tested people without symptoms and they found the virus, they'd make a mockery of their current requirement that only people with symptoms be tested? Were they embarrassed or concerned that someone other than the CDC was doing the testing? If so, then why didn't they just perform the tests themselves? Whatever the reason, 57 Americans spent 14 days quarantined in Omaha, then left without having any idea of whether they'd been infected or might still infect others. There is no way that 57 people from Wuhan were not shedding virus," said Lawler. At that moment, Carter guessed that the case fatality rate of the new virus, the percentage of people who got it that would die, fell somewhere between 0.5% and 1.1%. He further guessed that, if left unchecked by the government, it would infect between 20 and 40% of the U.S. population. The plan that he and Richard had created and passed off to the CDC back in 2006 classified pandemics in a way that made them sound like hurricanes, by how many Americans they were projected to kill if left unchecked. A disease projected to kill fewer than 90,000 Americans was a Category 1 and called for nothing more than home confinement of the obviously ill. A Cat 5, more than 1.8 million Americans. Or a Cat 4, 900,000 or more dead Americans required the CDC to call for all available measures. Isolate the ill, cancel all public gatherings, encourage telework, enforce social distancing, and close schools for up to 12 weeks. After his back-of-the-envelope calculation, Carter concluded that if the society failed to intervene, the virus would kill between 900,000 and 1.8 million Americans. The projected size of the outbreak is hard to believe, he wrote. According to the pandemic plan, the federal government should at least have been preparing the country for the full suite of interventions. It wasn't. So far as Carter could tell, it wasn't even working all that hard to keep track of the virus. Last thought before I go to bed, he wrote on the evening of January 27th. We have confirmed 5 cases in the U.S. We would estimate that the true number of cases might be 18 to 40 times that number. Say 100 to 200 already in the U.S. and we only know about 5 of them. At that moment, the CDC said it had 100 so-called PUIs, or persons under investigation. Thus far, 1 out of 7 people tested by the CDC had been infected by the virus. To find the 100 to 200 that Carter imagined were already roaming around the United States, the CDC would need to be testing 7 times that many people, or between 700 and 1,400. Right now, we are in containment, wrote Carter. Think of the cases that popped up across the U.S. like embers that are capable of starting a fire. As part of the containment strategy, we find these embers as quickly as possible and then stamp them out. This strategy only works for cases coming from the outside or for very short chains of transmission. It also requires incredible vigilance that is exhausting. Because the territory where embers could fall is so vast, it is easy to miss an ember. And where the ember falls matters. Does it fall into a pond or on an asphalt concrete parking lot or a green lawn or on some very dry leaves or pine straw? It is just a matter of chance where that ember falls and whether or not anything ignites and a fire starts and begins to spread. The next day, Richard wrote to Carter with a question. As the head of CEPI, Richard had the power to direct hundreds of millions of dollars to companies with new ideas about how to make vaccines more quickly than they had ever been made. It was interesting to note, and Richard noted it, that the free market had no interest in funding these companies in their early stages. Matt Hepburn's unit inside the Department of Defense had provided funding for most of them back when they were a glint in the founder's eye. Now CEPI was in a position to help them speed their vaccines through trials. They'd identified a Boston-area outfit called Moderna, an oddly named British-Swedish one called AstraZeneca, and several others as promising candidates that might develop a vaccine. The sooner CEPI's money went out the door, the sooner people would be vaccinated, and the sooner any pandemic would end. 4 days earlier, just after Carter generated his first view of the virus, CEPI had made a grant to Moderna to cover costs of the first 2 stages of clinical trials. I was getting a hell of a lot of heat inside CEPI that I had my hair on fire and had gone over the edge, recalled Richard. If the novel coronavirus turned out to be a reprisal of the 2009 flu, if nature had merely shot humans with another BB gun, the money would have been wasted and his donors would rebel. CEPI was at risk, and it had a chance to play a huge role in future pandemics, Richard felt. Grappling with both horns of the dilemma here, he wrote to Carter. We'd welcome you wrapping your brain around how to proceed in the most prudent way. Carter already had a view about these kinds of decisions. He thought that they should be approached the way an ICU doctor treated a patient clinging to life. Play forward whatever you are thinking about doing or not doing and ask yourself which decision, if you are wrong, will cause you the greatest regret. Richard agreed and never looked back. CEPI wound up handing out more than $1 billion to various manufacturers to speed the development of a vaccine. But hardly anyone else in positions of authority seemed to be thinking this way. I'm seeing comments coming from people asking why WHO and CDC seem to be downplaying this, wrote Carter. I'm certainly no public health expert, but no matter how I look at this, it looks bad. On January 31st, the United States government finally acted. Sort of. It restricted travel by foreigners into the country and required any Americans returning from China to quarantine for 14 days. We pretty much shut it down from coming in from China, said President Trump. By then, thought Carter, the virus was likely already so widespread inside the United States that the focus on foreign travelers was a pointless distraction. It was a waste of time, he wrote after Trump's announcement. You're protecting your front door from intruders, and they're taking your stuff out the back door. 4 days later, on February 4th, an infectious disease doctor within Veterans Affairs named Michael Gelman wrote to Carter. Gelman belonged to a small group of doctors scattered around the VA who, starting out, had bumped into Carter by accident and come to realize that when they had an impossible problem, they should throw it to him. They'd all discovered that Carter wouldn't intrude unless they asked him to. But once they'd asked for his help, his mind would sort of overrun whatever they were doing. The first time Gelman had written to Carter, it was to ask if Carter might help him with some complicated problem about hospital management. 37 minutes after I wrote to him, he responded with this long, perfectly thought-out answer, said Gelman. He's the vampire at the door, waiting patiently to be invited in. Gelman wanted to know just then what Carter was making of the novel coronavirus. As it happened, Carter had already written to his superiors in the VA to suggest that they should imagine waves of illness in the population of elderly veterans in six cities with the most inbound flights from China. New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, San Francisco, Seattle, and Atlanta. He'd checked flight schedules going back to early December. Carter thought that hospitals were likely to amplify the virus, as they wouldn't be prepared for it to walk in the front door. Here is the scenario I would prepare for and why, Carter wrote to the young VA doctor, in a message he also shared with the Wolverines. Then he went on. It is very likely that we have undetected community transmission in the United States and in many of the other 26 countries with confirmed cases in travelers. Except for the evacuees from Wuhan, nobody was screening asymptomatics. Some have likely slipped through our screening and our ongoing surveillance. It will take time for those numbers to increase to a level or signal that we will recognize. For the current time, we are going to be chasing after symptomatic patients who have traveled to China and monitor close contacts and find sporadic transmission among close contacts, primarily household contacts, like the cases in California and Illinois, both husband and wife transmission. But this is like the misdirection of a magician. We aren't seeing what we cannot see because we aren't looking for it. Sooner or later, the transmission that is now smoldering out of view is going to lead to someone presenting with pneumonia in an ER somewhere in the U.S. Staff in that ER will take a travel history and find no recent travel and treat the patient as a community-acquired pneumonia. He then explained how doctors not looking for the virus and therefore not finding it till it was too late would lead to a dramatic moment further into the future, when the American people woke up to the realization that they'd been overrun. It will feel like when the magician tells you to look over here. And we'll feel like we were thrown an unexpected curveball, and we'll be scrambling at that point to respond and to hurriedly reissue new guidance for screening and suspect case definitions. There will be urgency in implementing NPIs, non-pharmaceutical interventions, such as school closures and social distancing. And as we do, we will realize that just like in China, disease in the community is much greater than we realized. And we realize that we are now at the equivalent of 545 for the Man Gulch fire. What does one do in the Man Gulch fire at 545? How does one respond to the sight of a 30-foot-high wall of flame racing in one's direction? State and local health officers still had no ability to test, as they were waiting for a test being created by the CDC. The CDC itself was testing only sparingly. With so little testing capability, Carter argued, you had to be smart about how you test it. He hit upon an idea. Hospitals in the five biggest American cities should test anyone who showed up with flu-like symptoms. I thought, let's go on a fishing expedition, he said. I thought, why don't we focus on where we think it is? He began to track hospital reports of such cases and map them against numbers from previous years, and soon saw odd blips in Seattle and New York City. Those blips, he suspected, were cases being misdiagnosed as flu. The blip in Seattle would prove misleading, but the blip in New York, it became clear later, would have uncovered cases, likely a lot of them, had anyone bothered to test the patients. Carter was still regularly in touch with Tom Bossert, Trump's first Homeland Security advisor, and thought Bossert might offer a way to deliver messages to the White House. Bossert had cultivated a relationship with Trump and, even after John Bolton eliminated his position, felt Trump had once actually trusted him as much as Trump could trust anyone. But Bossert had come out publicly and refuted an idea being peddled by the White House during the first impeachment hearings, that the Ukrainians, not the Russians, had interfered in the 2016 election. From that moment, he was dead to the White House. Bossert had been reading the collected writings of Carter Mesher. He'd tried over and over again to get through to people near Trump, but as he put it, I kept getting blocked and blocked. Whatever was happening in the White House was happening without the benefit of the people Bossert felt qualified to advise the president. The chains had been broken, he said. None of the people who had been involved in the last 15 years of thinking about pandemics were in the conversation. They were deep state. Carter vented his swelling frustration in an email to the Wolverines. I am still having issues in VA with leaders avoiding the use of the term pandemic, and then not wanting to implement key portions of the VA pandemic plan because this is not a pandemic, he wrote. They will not say that word or use that word. They expect to see the term pandemic used by CDC and WHO. CDC continues to say this is not a pandemic. My response is that a pandemic is not defined by what is happening in the U.S. It is defined by what is happening across the world. Pan equals all, demic equals people, all people. I know that this is not CDC's intent, but it is creating problems for bureaucrats who suffer from malignant obedience. He and Richard and others had spent years creating and selling the ideas that would, if quickly seized upon, prevent a lot of Americans from dying. Those ideas were useful, and yet no one in authority seemed willing to use them. We were going nuts, said Carter. Each of the Wolverines went into their contact lists to look for what Carter called high-value nodes, people they knew who might influence American policy. Rajiv Venkaya had been at medical school with Amy Acton, director of the Ohio Department of Health, and a direct path to Ohio's governor, Mike DeWine. Dave Marcosi, now at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, was just a couple steps away from Maryland's governor, Larry Hogan. James Lawler knew the governor of Nebraska, Pete Ricketts. Matt Hepburn had the attention of people at the top of the Department of Defense. Lisa Coonan had retired from the Centers for Disease Control, but she could help Carter worm his way back into the place. maybe even get a meeting with the director. And they all knew Bob Catlick, the head of an abstruse but possibly powerful division inside the Department of Health and Human Services called the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, or ASPR. It had been Catlick who, way back at the end of the Bush administration, had dubbed Carter and the others Wolverines. The goal was to find at least one state to take the lead and roll out an aggressive response to the virus, introduce the social interventions outlined in the pandemic plan, and create a domino effect. "We had to create an epidemic for an idea," said Carter. At some point, Dwayne Kaniva realized that he had something to add. He'd been in the shock trauma unit that deployed with Marines on the battlefield in Fallujah. And not much rattled him, but he also knew what he didn't know. He'd worked with Carter Mesher and James Lawler in the Obama White House, but he didn't regard himself as really even being in the same field. "These were the guys I considered our national pandemic experts," he said, "not me." Dwayne was on his second president as the DHS's chief medical officer. His White House unit was meant to detect and prevent biological, chemical, and nuclear threats to Americans and assist the states in various medical emergencies. When he joined the Obama administration, the unit had employed nearly 200 people. The Trump administration had busted it up and sent pieces of it to other places and entirely neglected other pieces. By the middle of 2019, Dwayne found himself, more or less, on his own, grappling with such problems as how to deliver health care to the growing numbers of Central Americans and Mexicans detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, on the border. In late January and early February, Dwayne had been invited to the White House for National Security Council meetings to discuss what, if anything, to do about this new outbreak in Wuhan. He was disturbed by the lack of understanding or even information in those meetings. It was at once shocking and unsurprising to Dwayne that Carter Mesher, sitting at a desk in his bedroom in Atlanta, was creating a clearer view of a virus in China than anyone in the United States government. The CDC kept saying the response would be data-driven, but they weren't getting any data, said Dwayne, and any data they got was going to be a lagging indicator. They were calling the shots, and we needed someone else to call the shots. If the United States government wasn't even going to try to save the American people from the virus, the states would need to do it. In his 2 years inside Trump's Department of Homeland Security, Dwayne had had various dealings, many acrimonious, with various public officials in states that shared a border with Mexico. One struck him as just the type to grab hold of an entire state and turn it into an example that might lead the nation. "Just got off the phone with Dr. Charity Dean," Dwayne wrote on February 6, 2020, to his fellow Wolverines, before explaining who Charity Dean was and why he'd sent her all of their emails from the previous month. "She agrees that we're in Man Gulch." 8. In Man Gulch. It is easy for us to assume that as the result of modern science, we have conquered nature. That nature is now confined to beaches for children and to national parks where the few remaining grizzly bears have been shot with tranquilizers and removed to above the timberline, supposedly for their safety and our own. But we should be prepared for the possibility, even if we are going to accompany modern firefighters into Man Gulch, that the terror of the universe has not yet fossilized and the universe has not run out of blow-ups. Norman MacLean, Young Men in Fire. It has started. Charity was a doctor and thought herself, if not a scientist, at least scientifically minded. She didn't believe that she or anyone else had some mystical power to predict the future. She knew that the human mind played tricks on itself. She'd heard about the anchoring effect and confirmation bias in the rest. At the same time, she could not deny that these inchoate feelings that she sometimes had were as persuasive to her as data. Her initial tingle inside Tomaszewski's clinic had been like that. So had her first response to the UCSB student who might or might not have signaled a meningitis outbreak. If on December 21st, 2019, you had asked her what it was that had started, she couldn't have told you. But she'd had the feeling before. A picture formed in her mind. A giant wave. A tsunami. It's a foreboding, she said. A knowing that something is looming around the corner, like how when the seasons change, you can smell fall in the air right before the leaves change and the wind turns cold. I know things before they happen sometimes, although I can't put my finger on the details. Still, when Duane Kaneva called her, she was taken completely by surprise. They were hardly friends. If anything, the opposite. Their antagonism dated from her first days on the new job, back in late 2018, as the number two public health officer for California. She'd driven from Santa Barbara to an Airbnb in Sacramento and, that same day, been asked by then-Governor Jerry Brown to turn around and go back down south to the U.S.-Mexico border and, in effect, go to war with the Trump administration. A report had arrived on the governor's desk, a big caravan of would-be immigrants moving through Mexico in the general direction of San Diego. The local health officer in San Diego had declared it a federal problem, but the U.S. government at that moment seemed more keen to inflame the problem than solve it. Charity had heard that the Trump administration might be using new arrivals from Mexico as weapons in a public relations war. When space in the migrant shelters ran out, ICE workers would drive these people into cities in the dead of night and just leave them there. I'd heard that Trump was trying to create a crisis, said Charity, trying to turn people against immigrants. It was just a rumor. But when I get there, I find this is all true. They're just dumping families on street corners at 2 a.m. They were trying to create a disaster. Her assignment was to mitigate the health risks posed by the new arrivals. It was flu season. Drug-resistant tuberculosis could almost be counted as an export of several Mexican states. She never stopped worrying about chickenpox and measles. Measles had a spectacular R-naught of somewhere between 12 and 18, which is to say that each person who got it, on average, gave it to between a dozen and 18 others. In San Diego, volunteer workers had been picking migrants off the streets where United States immigration officers had dumped them and bringing them to Our Lady of Guadalupe Church, which had offered shelter. Inside the church, Charity found hundreds of tired, scared, and obviously unhealthy refugees. Each night, the church volunteers told her she should expect between 25 and 125 new arrivals. It felt like chaos, said Charity. The hallways are lined with families sitting on the floor. These are like mothers and babies who, by the way, have been kept in cages. She noticed how quiet and still the smaller children were. 3-year-olds don't behave like that, she said. They all looked shell-shocked. At first, she wasn't as concerned by what she saw as by what she smelled. Just by the odor, or lack of it, she was pretty sure that there was no gangrene and that there were no bacterial infections. You can't smell viruses, she said. But there's a smell when people are ill. You know how when your kid is sick and the smell of their breath changes. It's like that. She needed to set up a healthcare delivery system, fast, without the usual sources of help. The only medical supplies on hand had been brought by church volunteers from home medicine cabinets. The U.S. government under Donald Trump obviously would be of no use. San Diego County wanted nothing to do with it. She called the Red Cross, only to find that the Red Cross had no interest in helping either. She learned later that they didn't want to offend their Republican donors. The problem now belonged to the state of California, and she was now the state of California. At length, she reached a friend, an executive at Direct Relief, the massive Santa Barbara-based philanthropy dedicated to disaster aid. Caring for the ill and the hungry who had been detained while crossing the U.S.-Mexico border was no part of their mission, but she had come to know the executive and thought of him as a kindred spirit. I asked him, "Would you be willing to send supplies and money? And, oh, by the way, you won't be able to take credit for it." He was. Then she found a clinic in San Ysidro that was willing to accept the seriously ill. Then Jewish Family Service stepped in to help, and she was struck by how private American forces of mercy were straining to offset America's public agents of cruelty. She herself became a force of mercy. Technically, she was not supposed to see patients. She had her stethoscope with her, however, so she began to examine children. You just write a sign that says medical clinic and stick it on the door and it becomes one, she said. The first thing to do, she knew from her training with Dr. Hosey, was to learn her patient's social history. Where are you from was here the money question. Her patient's answers enabled her to check the vaccination rates in their home states and determine the communicable diseases to which they were most vulnerable. Her new migrant healthcare system spun up into a success. It would still be operational 2 years after she created it. She didn't know it at the time, but the feds who had created the problem that she had resolved noticed what she'd done. A few months later, she had an email from the Department of Homeland Security asking her to join their weekly call on border issues. After the death of some Mexican children in ICE's supposed care, Congress was pressuring the Trump administration to explain the healthcare system on the U.S.-Mexico border. There wasn't one. At least none that anyone cared to describe in a congressional hearing. The Department of Homeland Security had tracked down Charity Dean in a panic to ask her how she'd done what she had done, because they wanted to reproduce it elsewhere. They went from wanting a crisis to, "Oh shit, we need to keep kids from dying," said Charity. By then, she knew that the Trump administration had been flying migrants in transport planes from Texas to California so that they might create more stress on the system she had built and, at the same time, take advantage of it. She got on the phone with this Dwayne guy and another colleague, a tough bullying type from Texas, who began by mansplaining to her how to manage an outbreak and then tried to deny the existence of the flights. At which point I was like, fuck you, I was there, I saw it. A few days later, the flights stopped. Charity never learned why. When Dwayne Caniva got back in touch with her, she didn't think of him as an ally. "I saw him as a stormtrooper for Trump," she said. She surely was not prepared for what he had to say. "His voice was different than all the other times I'd talked to him," said Charity. "It was kind of low and quivering. I thought, oh my God, he's doing something illegal." Suddenly, there was this other Dwayne. This Dwayne who was telling her that he belonged to this small, informal, almost secret group of doctors who had once worked in the White House under Bush or Obama and were now scattered to the four winds, but not without influence. This Dwayne was now working, without the White House's permission, to coordinate some kind of national pandemic response. It was clear that he was doing something he knew could possibly get him into trouble and get me into trouble, she said. He needed her help, he explained, and getting what this secret group of doctors had to say to the governor of the nation's most populous state, so that it might take the lead for the country, as the White House clearly was not going to. I was like, wait a second, said Charity. There's a group of people, a break glass group, who meet during pandemics. Thinking it over, she decided that whatever Dwayne was doing probably wasn't actually illegal. It was just wildly insubordinate. Plus, it was an admission that she might actually be useful to him. Just to call me, he had to humble himself, which said to me, this must be important, she said. At any rate, this new Duane Kaneva wasn't a stormtrooper for Donald Trump. He was part of the resistance. If discovered, he'd likely be fired. She loved it when people were brave. Bravery always had her at hello. That he had that in him, I didn't know, said Charity. After the call, she read the massive strings of emails Duane had forwarded, pages and pages of insight into the virus that, whatever the CDC might say, she suspected was already spreading inside the United States. I went through all their old email chains, she said. I devoured them like a starving person. At that moment, the world felt as upside down to her as it ever had. She had sold a house she loved and left Santa Barbara with her three young sons, only to have her ex-husband decide that, no, he'd rather have the children remain in Santa Barbara. She was prepared to give up a lot for the new job, but not them. And then the job wasn't what she had expected it to be. Working for the state of California wasn't like working for the county of Santa Barbara, only bigger and better. There had been very few occasions that required her to rise to them. The border crisis in San Diego had been an exception. Most days she felt trapped at a desk inside a massive faceless bureaucracy. Often the work felt mundane, impersonal, low stakes. Did she really want to spend her days sorting out tedious inefficiencies in the licensing and certification of California's hospitals? Plus, no one inside the 4,500-person operation that was the California Department of Public Health knew what anyone else did. People thought it weird that she tried to learn. She'd been installed in an office on the 7th floor on a hall with the rest of the department's leadership. The first few weeks in Sacramento, she'd stepped off the elevator at random floors and walked around introducing herself to figure out who did what and to invite them to the 7th floor for coffee whenever they wanted. Her little walkabouts ended when a friendly colleague took her aside and said, I think you're making people uncomfortable. 7th floor people didn't just walk around the other floors. After that, she stopped getting off at other floors. The most disorienting aspect of the job by far was her new boss. Charity had assumed that she herself would replace her old boss, Dr. Karen Smith, whenever Dr. Smith stepped down. That's why Dr. Smith had brought her in the first place. Dr. Smith had left in June 2019, and for the next few months, Charity had filled her shoes. But then, in October, she was returned to her original position. The new governor, Gavin Newsom, broke with the tradition of naming a former local California health officer to run the state when he instead brought in Sonia Angel, a former CDC employee in the agency's non-communicable disease unit. Angel had experience in neither California nor communicable disease. Her most recent job had been working on heart disease in New York City's health department. Only later in August 2020, at the press conference where he announced Angel's abrupt resignation, without going into why she was resigning so abruptly, would Newsom explain why, in part, she'd been recruited by his administration. Her work in writing racial injustice in healthcare. Charity was later told that she herself had never been a serious candidate. It was an optics problem, says a senior official in the Department of Health and Human Services. Charity was too young, too blonde, too Barbie. They wanted a person of color. Sonia Angel identified as Latina. The first thing Karen Smith had asked Charity to do was to resolve a crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border. The first thing Sonia Angel asked her to do was to figure out how to set the time on the clock on her desk phone. Charity never used her desk phone. She had no idea how the clock on the thing worked, but her new boss said that without it, she would not be able to tell the time, and so the clock must be fixed. As Charity fiddled with the phone, she thought to herself, "This isn't my job." and finally arranged to have someone who actually knew how the desk phones worked set the phone's clock. She also found her new boss a tailor, a hairdresser, and a dry cleaner, and, well, at first it seemed to Charity that her new boss was asking her to do things as a way of becoming friends. She worked to dismiss the thought that her new boss was asking her to do these things to remind her of her place. Charity wasn't particularly well suited to being reminded of her place, and was further unsettled when Rank and Falstaff began to turn up in her office to complain about the new boss. After a while, it just felt like mean girls, said Charity. I decided to suck it up and pretend everything was fine. Suck it up she did during the days. The nights were not so simple. For the past year, she'd told herself a story. She'd left behind all these things she'd loved in Santa Barbara, but for a purpose. Something was coming, and she was rising into a position to confront it. That story no longer rang true. I had given up everything to come here and take this job, she said. I was like, holy shit, why did I do this? Then came the virus. Charity had started to follow the events in Wuhan in early January, about the same time that Carter Mesher pointed the virus out to his fellow Wolverines. Like Carter, she had set out to learn what she could about it, and also, like Carter, she was surprised by how little there was to find. I'm the number two health person in the biggest state in the country, she said. I'm expert in communicable diseases and trained to control them. And there is nowhere for me to look. There was no place where she could get a reliable take on the things she needed to know to make any sort of prediction about how the virus might play out in California. Its R-naught, its infection fatality rate, the rate at which it sent people to the hospital. She wanted to know how much time passed from the moment people were infected to the moment they became infectious, the incubation period, and how much, if any, time passed between the moment they became infectious and the onset of symptoms, when they would know to isolate themselves. The perfect pathogen has a very long infectious period and a very long incubation period, because the longer it takes for the pathogen to declare itself, the harder it is to track, she said. One reason measles was so wildly transmissible was that a person with it was infectious for 4 days before he knew he had it. This new thing felt to her a bit like that, just watching how the Chinese were reacting to it. China was behaving like this was the perfect pathogen, she said. Like Carter, she started Googling and reading Chinese newspapers. I knew that I needed to get as close to the source as I could get, she said. Twitter was a great resource. By mid-January, someone had posted video of the Chinese authorities welding the doors on homes in Wuhan to keep the people infected with the virus inside. It looked pretty real, but I didn't know if I could believe it, she said. Many months before, she had subbed at the last minute for Governor Newsom at his request as host to a delegation of fancy Chinese doctors. She and the Chinese doctors had discussed, among other things, pandemics and how to respond to them. I said, hold on. What would cause that group of doctors to, say, solder the doors shut on apartment buildings with suspect cases? Said Charity. I mean, locking people in buildings to die was not part of their ops plan. She read the Journal of the American Medical Association and The Lancet and every other publication generating quick takes out from Wuhan. She found data in bits and pieces, all the while knowing that she'd never have the data she'd need to act, or rather, that by the time she had that data, it would be too late to act. The data was super sketchy, but that's the job. Using scattered information from unreliable sources to make decisions, she said. And I wasn't just looking for data. I was looking for all those little clues that something is wrong. Soon she had a rough idea of the virus's behavior in Wuhan. The R-naught, the hospitalization rate, and the fatality rates. Using these, she played out its spread in California. Assuming that the first case of transmission inside the state had occurred by early January and using a reproductive rate of 2.5, she drew on her office whiteboard a so-called epicurve. It described the next 5 months with infections on the y-axis and time on the x-axis. When she'd finished, she saw that the curve resembled a giant wave, a tsunami. By June, if the government did nothing to mitigate the virus's spread, 20 million or so Californians would have been infected. 2 million would have required hospitalization, and 100,000 of them would have died. And that didn't count the people who died of other illnesses they might have survived had there been an open bed in the hospital. She erased the whiteboard and did the math all over again with the most optimistic assumptions that were still plausible. "The numbers seemed nuts to me," she said. "What I was really doing at that whiteboard was coming to terms with exponential growth." Fairly certain that her boss wouldn't want to hear about the numbers, she waited for a week to mention them. A week later, her boss was still not ready for the news. "I started to say that this could be a big deal and we should put a plan together, but Sonia didn't let me finish," recalled Charity. "She cut me off and said, 'If this is a real thing, the CDC will tell us.'" The CDC, Charity knew, already had its mantra: "The risk to the American people is very low." Nancy Messonnier, a senior CDC official, had been saying that, and Sonia Angel often repeated it, right up until the end of February. "She was looking for the CDC to pull the fire alarm," said Charity. "The CDC does not know how to pull the fire alarm. In fact, there is no fire alarm in this country." By the third week of January, Charity Dean, like Carter Mesher, did not believe that the risk to the American people was low. She thought that the virus was already spreading exponentially inside the United States. The first death caused by COVID-19 recorded in the United States occurred in Seattle on February 28th. In late April, Santa Clara County reclassified two earlier deaths after figuring out that they, too, had been caused by COVID-19. The first had occurred on February 6th, the second on February 17th. Both patients would have been infected by the virus roughly a month before death. As neither victim had traveled outside the area, the virus had clearly been circulating in the Bay Area by early January. It was as if she and she alone had spotted the fire in Man Gulch, and no one else was willing to turn and run. She sent out a survey to California's hospitals to get a sense of how many beds they could create in rooms with negative air pressure. That is, rooms that did not allow whatever might be exhaled by a patient to escape. She looked into the capacity of the morgues. "Everyone forgets about the morgues," she said. "It's the part of the healthcare system that's never included in disaster response preparations." She went to bed at night thinking about the need to establish sites for mass graves. "A switch flipped in me mid-January," she said. "My whole being came alive." She found the old pandemic plan and dusted it off. It had come from the CDC, and like all the CDC papers, it was well done. "They really should just change the name," she said. "It shouldn't be the Centers for Disease Control. It should be the Centers for Disease Observation and Reporting. That's what they do well." She had no idea who exactly had written the plan for a flu pandemic or what had prompted it, but it was hugely useful as a starting point for anyone hoping to mitigate the damage caused by any disease without the help of antivirals or vaccines. It was really useful because it basically said, "We're in 1918. There are no medical countermeasures. What do we do? Here are the tools." No one was asking her to write a battle plan for the state of California, but she wanted to be ready in case they did. On January 20th, the virus made the television news. Charity seized upon that as an excuse to bring the subject up more bluntly with her boss. "I knew it was going to be a delicate balance," she said, "of not seeming to know something she didn't know or not raising an alarm that she didn't raise." It wasn't long into the meeting before Charity realized she'd failed to achieve the balance. Afterward, Angel banned her from using the word pandemic and told her to erase the math and the tsunami curve on her whiteboard. "She told me I was scaring people," said Charity. "I said, shit, they should be scared." From that moment, Charity found herself left off email chains and not informed of meetings. "The way you do it in government is not explicit," she said. "It has to be subtle." She just left me out of everything. It was just leaving me completely out and saying, "This isn't your area." The first few weeks of January, she had not slept well or eaten properly. I'd be lying in bed trying to imagine how it was going to play out. Which cities would be cordoned off first? Which people would we let die? On January 22nd, her heart began to beat strangely, and she visited a cardiologist who confirmed she'd developed an arrhythmia, fitted her for a heart monitor, and told her to take it easy. "It's like Noah building the ark," said Charity. "Everyone thinks you are totally crazy." For maybe both better and worse, she was just then reading, or rather rereading, over and over again, a section in the second volume of William Manchester's biography of Winston Churchill. The book described the years 1932 to 1940, when Churchill was out of power and watching with mounting frustration and anger as British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain minimized the rise of Adolf Hitler. "Alone," the book was subtitled. Charity was less interested in World War II than in the events leading up to it. The book had sat on her bedside table for the past 18 months. She remained fixated on the run-up to the agreement made by Chamberlain with Hitler in Munich on September 30, 1938. To avoid war with Germany, Chamberlain had caved to Hitler's demand for a chunk of what was then Czechoslovakia. He'd then returned home to a temporarily grateful British public and, to a cheering crowd, had delivered remarks in which he said that Great Britain had achieved peace with honor. Churchill had issued his own statement in response to less fanfare. "You were given the choice between war and dishonor," he said. "You chose dishonor, and you will have war." Churchill had no data either, but he was able to see the threat Hitler presented when others did not, because he was not blinded by a desire for peace. A history Charity had started for pleasure had become something else. She didn't so much read it as investigate it, the way she might an outbreak of tuberculosis. By late January, she'd underscored half the lines on the pages leading up to Great Britain's declaration of war, and scribbled comments in every margin. "Chamberlain publicly accused Churchill of lacking judgment," she wrote. "The leaders with the worst judgment smugly claim they have the best." A bit farther on, "Don't prepare a white paper when you need to be bombing the shit out of Germany." Chamberlain had spent the final few days before the war writing a white paper that defended his strategy of appeasement. After that, "There will be no standing ovation when you are proven right." And finally, Churchill was a dragon too. Occasionally, she wondered if the tendency to remain forever on red alert, to always be straining to look around the corner to see what might be coming, might be classified as a neurosis. "My whole life I've been preparing for a war," she said. Now she saw very clearly that the enemy was attacking, and no one but she herself felt the urgency of the situation. Everywhere she turned in government, she saw this distinction in leaders between Churchill's and Chamberlain's. The people who presided in times of peace tended to have a gift for avoiding or at least disguising conflict. People made for battlefield command did not find their way into positions of authority, at least not until the general public sensed existential risk. By then, by the time people knew enough about a communicable disease to be terrified, the war's most critical phase was over. She had spent her life preparing for just this moment. Now, when you attacked the virus and contained it before it overran California. And yet she was now less relevant than at any time since she'd gone into public service as the deputy health officer in Santa Barbara County. "I was feeling worthless and useless," said Charity. "It didn't appear that me being here for the state meant anything." Everyone has a story they tell themselves about themselves. Even if they don't explicitly acknowledge it, their minds are at work retelling or editing or updating a narrative that explains or excuses why they have spent their time on Earth as they have. A decade earlier, in the story that played on the loop inside the mind of Charity Dean, she'd cast herself as the victim. She had every reason to do so. Every terrible thing that a man can do to a woman, short of killing her, some man had done to her. After the difficult birth of her third child, she had stopped consuming alcohol in a normal way and started to use it. A drink could make the story she was telling herself